welcome to the Role Models Podcast. My name is David Noel. Together with my friend Isabel, I'm one of the co-creators of Role Models, and I'm the host of this very podcast, where every week I interview successful women about the things they've learned in life and career. My guest in this episode is Alex Constantinople. Alex is the CEO of the Outcast Agency, a communications and marketing agency that works with companies like Airbnb, Spotify, Instagram, Amazon, or Facebook. Alex started her career on the East Coast as a publicist at CNN and NBC before moving to the West Coast to join Wired magazine. Once in San Francisco, she joined Outcast as a COO and within 12 months became the agency's CEO. In this episode, Alex and I cover a lot of ground. We start off by talking about the books that she loves most and the books that she goes back to reread. We talk about the decision to take a leave of absence or sabbatical and how to prepare for your absence as a CEO. We talk about building a healthy work culture that allows people to blend their life at work with their life outside of work. We talk about how to network when this is not your strength and the importance of building strong relationships. Two things I learned from Alex, which I loved. Every quarter, she tries to meet 10 new people. And every year, she takes time to make an assessment of her life and her work. Big thanks to our patrons of this episode who support the creation of this podcast with $10 per episode. Here's Megan Quinn, Anna Caroline, and Tim Herbig. You can find the links to the organizations that they support in the show notes. Big thanks to them. And if you would like to make a contribution, please visit patreon.com/role models. This is the Role Models Podcast. This is episode 21. Thank you for listening. And this is my guest, Alex Constantinople. Alex Constantinople, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Alex, you are the CEO of Outcast Agency, which is a San Francisco-based communications and marketing agency, and I cannot wait to dive into it and to learn about the story, how you get to where we're sitting right now in a conference room in the agency. And I wanted to start off with the first question being, I saw on your Twitter bio that you're an avid reader. Mm-hmm. What's the current book you're reading?
Yes, it's Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. And I'm actually part of a women's resistance book club, as one does right now, post-election of 2016, very San Francisco. And so that was our newest pick. So I'm actually really enjoying it. I'm not usually a Margaret Atwood fan, but I'm in the context of everything, very Orwellian, and I'm enjoying it.
What would you say, so to put on the bio that you're an avid reader or that you spend a lot of time reading, what would you say have been some of the books that that shaped you as a person most?
I have one book that I reread all the time, probably more than any book. And I'm actually not someone who rereads a lot of things. I actually have this thing I've been thinking about a lot recently in my lovely approaching 48, that I don't like to go to reunions. I don't like to look back a lot. I'm very much sort of a push forward. I don't get scared of what's ahead either. I'm not like, oh my God, I'm going to turn 50. This is terrible. I am a very sort of come what may person. But I really don't like also retracing steps. And I think it was probably in my mind because it was just my 30th high school reunion and I had zero interest in going back. So the notion of rereading something I've already read when there's so much out there that I could get my hands on is something I usually sort of just dismiss out of hand. But I find myself rereading The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham probably every couple of years since I first read it in high school.
Why?
I have so many versions that are underlined. It's funny. I always buy a new version. I never reread the same version because I found I did look at one point what I'm underlining is different each time. So I can't really say here is why. It just speaks to me.
What is it about?
Well, in general, it's just sort of a man's journey, you know? And so I think that's probably why I have been attracted to it, that I'm on a journey. I'm very cognizant of that. And then I've always had a very sort of fatalistic view of life, of everything happens for a reason. And even in the worst times, I have to have something to hang on to. There has to be a meaning there that gets me through. I think that's sort of the essence of the book, at least to me. So I'm sure there are many people out there, English literature professors, who would disagree, but that's what I get out of it. So
how many times have you read it?
Well, gosh, I would say now easily, I don't know, 15 times. You know, I love it. I actually am trying. I grew up with parents who are avid readers. I think that's why also. And now I sort of am for, you know, I have nieces that hang in hammocks and trees and read books constantly. And I have two of my three are definitely not like that. And it bugs me. Hi, kids. I'm trying to work on the last one right now. And because to me, to always have a book next to your bed and multiple books, my dad jumped around always from history. He just had 10 books on the side of his bed. He was always reading all of them. And I couldn't understand it at the time. And now I do. You know, it depends on what your mood is. You've had a long day at work. You get into bed. You're so tired. And when I actually, it's one of those things that I realized too in an exercise I did with myself probably 7 years or so ago of what makes me happy. And reading is one of those things. It's just a personal joy of mine. So, I now have lots of Bruce Springsteen's autobiography next to my bed that I sort of pick up. Occasionally I have Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse next to my bed. It's random, but, you know, and then I love myself a People magazine. So it kind of goes
mix it up.
Yeah, I don't want to be too.
What is something that you're most excited about right now?
That's a very hard question to answer sort of from a macro level in my life. I just feel like the world, especially if we're sitting here, you know, talking when things aren't that great in the world right now. But in a very sort of micro point of view, I'm actually taking a leave of absence from work this summer. We offer it to our employees if you've been here for 5 years or more. And I thought to myself last summer with you know, this summer I have a 16-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And I thought, you know what, I can tell the way the 16-year-old is talking, you know, he wants a job in future summers, and it's the beginning of the end. So I thought, you know what, I should take the leave myself. Is there any reason for me running the company? You immediately think, oh gosh, it can't apply to me. There's no way I could take that time off. And I just sort of made it happen. Declared it. And I'm taking them on a U.S. history tour up the East Coast. Same thing after the election. I found their knowledge of California history very strong, but their knowledge of how our government works and how we were founded, not as strong. And to be finishing a freshman, you know, sixth grade, and I'll give the first grader a break, that bummed me out.
That's very cool. So yeah. Talk a little bit. That's a great, great thing to do. How long is the break?
So I'm going to do 5 weeks. I probably will regret and wanted to, you know, make, I should have taken six, but that's okay. I'm going to do five and take the month of July off, and a little bit into August, and we're going to do it. And I'm so excited. I've been planning it a lot with them. They're all at those just great ages. And even for myself, there's things, you know, we're going to go to DC where I'm from. I grew up in Washington, do some things there that I've never done. You know, that sometimes happens. I'm sure from where you're from, you're like, gosh, I've never only do that when people are in town. And then make our way from Philly to New York to Boston. So we're researching it all now. I gave each child a city, and we're sort of then they have to come back, and we all sort of decide, you know, they sort of lead on the research and then say, okay, this is what we should do. So we're making those plans now.
So that's cool. So the company enables everybody who's been here for 5 years to do this, which is great. And I think the idea of sabbatical is something that comes up a little bit in my surroundings a bit. Can you talk a bit about, you mentioned briefly that it was, you know, a bit of a fight to see, should I do this? Now is not the right time. Talk a little bit about the decision making of actually doing it, which might help others who are maybe considering to do a break like this, but have too many reasons not to do it. Like what did you learn now having made the decision? What did you learn from that process?
It's so much easier. You know, and I'm the queen of in my head having many conversations. One of my sayings is I'll discuss it with myself and get back to you, because there's invariably, I just overthink things. And so this one was more, oh gosh, I'm the quote unquote boss. So what will happen then? And I'm in the client service business. So what will other people think? And then it very just quickly turned to, and I'm sure you are like this too, when you have something so deeply you believe in and you want to do, and you know that, you know, you're set up for success, it's sort of you realize very quickly you're the only person in your way. And so obviously I wanted to make sure we have a really strong management team here. It's something that we've been very purposeful about. I have a COO who's amazing and a group of people that we manage the company as a team. And so to me, I also thought, well, okay, they're there. So, you know, and I take vacations and everyone seems to be fine. So, and I did ask, we have a board, and I asked the CEO of our parent company and obviously went through all the right things and channels to make sure that everybody who needed to be okay are aware of it. But I really wasn't asking. It was something that I just deeply believed in. I spent, which I know we'll get to, but a large part of my career sort of missed my older kids' early years. And I don't regret it. It is what it is. It got me to where I am today. But I feel very much that there's a window of time here that I have with them. And I this is something I want to do. So I'm doing it.
What makes it so hard for us to almost fear the consequences of taking time for ourselves? Like why haven't we gotten to a place where it feels so scary to take time off, to invest in ourselves, to invest in our families, to invest in our sanity?
You know, I can't obviously speak for other people. For me, it was a rock bottom. You know, I just had this moment where I worked, for a company that I gave everything to, and through no fault of their own. That's what companies do, right? They are takers, and you will work extremely hard for them, and they do their job, which is pay you and, you know, give you benefits, and off you go. And I think I came to that point where I really realized that everything I had worked in my career towards, I actually didn't want, if it meant giving up this other part of my life. So once you get to that spot where you're miserable, really, I mean, you're just unhappy, you do things that you will never go back to that spot. And I'm laughing when you first said that, because I went away for a weekend. I do one thing with my, for myself, I do lots of things for myself, but every time sort of that bonus season comes around, I'm like, you know what? I work my ass off and I want to do one thing just for me. You know, I know there's bills and everything. And I tell that to people here, either if it's your very first bonus or you've been working really hard and, you know, you've been doing this for quite some time, do one thing for yourself just as a treat. You know, so anyway, I did this weekend away with a friend. We went to kind of a spa thing, and my oldest son was like, "Wow, you're really good at me time, aren't you?" And I was like, "Yes, I am. Thank you." And I work really hard. And I think I've just over the years been much more in touch with what are the things that makes me, you know, make me happy, and making sure I do them. And actually the founders of Outcast, when I started working at the company, I explained to them, look, I have kids and I'm not, you know, so I just want to make sure I can do this. And they're like, absolutely. You know, it's your schedule. Make sure you work on that and just own whatever it is that you need to do. And they sort of explained to me how they did it as they were young moms at the time. And it was just so refreshing. So I've sort of held on to, you know, I leave here at 4:30. I come in at 8:30, but I leave here at 4:35. I am home for, you know, after school stuff. I have flexibility, and I've just made sure that, you know, and by the way, I'm really selfish. I tell the kids that, like, I read all my papers in the morning and nobody talked to me. I love to go and do my stuff on the weekends. I see friends. I feel like I'm much more in touch with, just doing those things, of which part of it is being with them and my husband and other things, you know, but a lot of stuff just by myself.
Is it something that you talk about in throughout the company to model this kind of to model the importance of taking some time off and also to invest it back into yourself, like especially for people earlier in their career who are super eager and ambitious and
absolutely
busy? And so how do you, is this something you encourage people to think about here at Outcast?
I do. I very much. In fact, the company's 20 years old this month in June. And one of the founding values we've never changed, which is excellence, integrity, and balance. And I think balance has been something that I spend a lot of time talking about, because it can be just, what does that mean? It's kind of just a word thrown up there, or is there what's, you know. But to me, the company, actually, our job is not to define balance for you. And I learned this in my career, in the moment I was saying that I sort of hit rock bottom, was having a conversation with the CEO of that company at the time. who said, well, what do you mean? You know, just because I travel 265 days a year doesn't mean that you guys have to. But that's how the company was run. Everybody was sort of charging after this pattern of kind of craziness, just, you know, never home, constant travel, you know, et cetera. And so basically his spiel to me at that time was, it is not my job. You know, that works for me. Like, it's good. My wife's fine with it. My kid is okay with it, but that's just me. Like, I'm shocked that the rest of the employees would think that they have to model after me. And I was like, I'm shocked that you think that you would not understand that. Right. And so, but in the essence, what I've taken here now in my job is what he was saying, which was, I don't know what works for you. You have to figure that out. We as a company should enable you to do that. And if you have a problem living a life that you want to have, then of course you should talk to your manager, you know, or talk to HR, et cetera. And I thought about it. I went away and I was a little bit pissed, to be honest, in the beginning. I was like, oh, he just doesn't get it, you know. And then now that I am a CEO of a company, much smaller than the one that he was, but I see that, you know, and I it's very liberating for me to own the fact that they know I'm a hot mess most days, right? Like, some kid's left a trombone. I sit out there with everyone. I try to let them see that this is my reality, but this is my reality. You might be 24 years old. This is your second job out of college and you can't relate, you know, to me at all, which I don't expect you to, but I want you, it could be anything, yoga, therapy, your friends, best friends in town, your parents, your family, a class you might be taking, whatever it is that makes you whole and happy. The company should allow you, Outcast should be a place where you can do that. And that is what I meet with new employees every month, you know, anybody new in the company. And I sort of go through this because it's so important to me that they understand. Because at the end of the day, also, no matter where you are, you're going to work your ass off here. That's expected. This is a very hard charging, intense place. So it's not one for the other. But at the end of the day, you need to also take care of yourself. But the company won't tell you what that looks like, because for every single person here, it's different. And I'm very open, finally, because I spent many years also kind of a closeted mom, working mom. And that's no fun either. So I want people to be very upfront. You know, don't sneak out the back door. If you want to go work out in the middle of the day, go work out in the middle of the day. I don't care, you know. But at the end of the day, we also expect you do your part of the bargain, which is the work part. and then we'll be good, you know. And I think people really have resonated to that. It's really helped our culture to be very open about that.
Well, as somebody who 2 years ago took a sabbatical as well, and I traveled around the world after hitting rock bottom as
well.
You did?
Oh, interesting.
After 6 years with a company, almost like I would have said it was a year too late. I should have done it earlier. Mm-hmm. Should have invested in myself and my health, physical and mental,
yes,
way earlier.
Yes.
So I can appreciate it, and I wish you a great time.
Thank you.
I can't wait to reconnect with you after,
yes,
you're back to
I
see
know
how it went.
And I'm really actually we do KPIs, you know, quarterly, and one of mine is really checking out for this break, you know, because in the past I will sort of take myself off a lot of things, but I'm still available. And of course I said you can text me or whatever, but I am going to really, really put that out of office on my email. So yeah. That's my test. Can I do it?
So here's a tip.
Yep.
If you want the way I protected myself of being disconnected was that I asked somebody on my team. So at 6 p.m. the day I left, I went into my email account and into the settings, and I asked my colleague to choose a password and to my email account. And then I told him, if I contact you 4 weeks in, do not just ignore it. If I contact you 6 weeks in, just ignore it. If I contact you 2 weeks before I come back, you may consider it.
I love that.
And I didn't, of
that.
Course. I never looked at it.
I think this will be good. It's sort of the old when I had my, you know, first child and I went to the pediatrician. I was like, I'm just traveling so much for work and I'm so miserable. And she was like, look, the kids need a break from you too. Like, don't feel guilty. Like, it's not a big deal. And I feel not that people here are children at all, but it is that same notion. Like, they'll be fine. And this will be good for everybody. Like, you know, there is a world, you know, out after me. And so just what's the worst thing that's going to happen?
We will talk more about leadership, yeah, later on. But it's exactly like you said, the moment the leader steps away or steps aside, it's a time for somebody else to step
exactly
up and
right
to fill that spot. That's and exactly take the opportunity. We'll talk more about that.
Okay,
you mentioned you were born and raised in Washington. Take us back. Like, who's Alex? What's the background?
Yes.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Washington, D.C. My parents grew up in D.C. Their parents, for the most part, grew up there as well. So it's interesting, and none of us are really in politics. And I loved it. I absolutely loved growing up there. It's a hard to go back there now. It's a pretty small town, and your local news is national news, which is what I loved. So there was constant discussion, even if my parents and my extended family weren't directly in politics, you had it all around you at all times. So I feel like I got this amazing seat at world news, really, from a very early age. An incredibly intellectually curious family. Some who started their own businesses, some who were, my dad was a urologist, is still practicing. And my mom started her own company as well. And that's, I feel like, where I sort of got my first taste. I worked for both of them in the summers when I was younger and had this really, I would say, D.C. is that nice combination of sort of suburban urban, because you can live in a neighborhood and be 15 minutes from downtown. So I feel like it was fantastic that way, you know, just constantly up on the news, very, you know, museums everywhere, just lots of art and opera and music and lots of conversations. And every night we had a family dinner, even if we had to wait for my dad to get home from the hospital, which is usually 8 or 8:30, which is challenging for hungry kids. But I now appreciate that so much. So it was, and then constantly, you know, running into family members. So that can be fantastic and not so fantastic when you're older. So you kind of were never out of an eyeball away, like, oh, I saw Alex over here when I was supposed to be somewhere else. It was wonderful. I went to an all-girls school from 4th through 12th grade.
What would you say, so growing up in D.C., surrounded by politics and news and making it a topic around the dinner table, what would you say were the things and the people who influenced your journey and how you got to where you are?
Very much my parents. My dad's work motto, or sort of motto in life basically, is work as hard as you can for as long as you can. And so that was very much, we all had chores very early, lots of responsibility. They were young when they had me. I'm the oldest. And so they were in their early 20s. And then I have my youngest sister's 34 now. So there was a big gap. And so, you know, and my mom was working. I had two working parents. So we did a lot, you know, and I love that. When I look back on it, I think I was miserable in the beginning. Like, don't you think I'm going to be babysitting when I'm in high school for Nell? But I look back on it and it really influenced me, not just a work ethic. I mean, my mom starting her own company and was very successful at that. And then same thing, just seeing my dad, and always, he never, ever talked about patients. But one of the things that I still just kind of get goosebumps is when someone might say to me, and Constantinople is such a, you know, uncommon name, and you know, they'll say, oh, is your dad a doctor? Oh, he's my doctor. And he's just the most wonderful bedside man, you know, go on and on and on. And he will have never said anything to me. Right. Obviously he can't. And that's just, so that was pretty much my growing up in Washington. I just loved it. I'm sure I'm babbling. I don't know what I'm saying. You can edit that out.
That's all good. You mentioned a name. Like, what's the heritage? Where's the name from?
Yeah, actually, my dad's dad was Greek, and I believe he came over. I have so many historians in my family that will kill me if I get this wrong, but I believe it's 1904. They came through Baltimore from a small village in Greece, and actually the name was Constantinopolis, and then it was changed through. And then everybody, this particular group was Northern Virginia and DC. And then the rest of the family is sort of an Irish British mix of other things.
So growing up in Washington, you eventually left the city and the state to go to college in Ohio, right?
I did. I went to school in Ohio, which was very purposeful in one way of, I'm probably never ever going to live in the Midwest is what I thought. So try a different part of the country. And I loved it. The weather is bizarre. Every day is 10 different kind of weather patterns. You know, I learned pop and sack and all these other terms. It was sort of just getting out of my little bubble of just being in DC pretty much my whole life. And Chicago was Paris. You would just, any car going to Chicago, you would throw yourself in and check out Chicago for the weekend. And I had a blast. I made amazing lifelong friends. And so, yeah, that was my 4 years. And I worked every summer, sort of got out of Ohio, never really did again the Midwest thing, but still to this day.
What did you study?
I was English major and an art history minor in the end. And I have one regret that I didn't really push myself I should have English literature. Now I'm looking back on it, even though, yes, I'm a huge reader, I probably should have picked something sort of more interesting at the time. To me, that was what was easy.
Like what?
I actually loved art history. I should have flipped it, frankly. You know, it was all new to me. I had been exposed to it as, you know, a family who always went to things, but I didn't know what I was looking at. And so I definitely could have flipped it. I also love history, and I wish I had taken more history classes.
That's why you're going on his history trip.
This is why I'm going on a history trip. Yeah.
So I want to dive into your career. Forgive me if I put this the wrong way, but it looks like so you entered your career into the media and entertainment communications area as a publicist. And when I look at your bio, it looks like a straight line. And I'm sure it's not. When you look back at your career, what would you say were some of the winding elements of that journey?
It's so interesting that is your perception of it, because I think you're actually right that it was a straight line. You know, I ended up working for CNN, for Larry King, and I sort of, so much of it is luck. You know, I ended up working for him. I'd applied to be an intern at CNN, and then I had worked for the Commission on Presidential Debates that sponsor the presidential debates every 4 years, and I'd met someone through that. Anyway, as usual things go, you know, you try to network the hell out of yourself, and I ended up almost applying for an internship at CNN, and then someone yanked me and said, oh, you should be Larry's publicist. Well, he was kind of he was doing his radio and his USA Today column, for those of you who remember, that was just random thoughts with ellipses. And then Ross Perot announced he was going to run for president on his show. And then the next thing I knew, I was negotiating with 60 Minutes, and I was doing, you know, all kinds of things, a lot of mistakes, like letting him, you know, be on a treadmill in his underwear for Lifestyles and the Rich and Famous, that Robin Leach show. This guy was just horrible. Anyway, it was awesome and painful all at the same time, because I didn't know what I was doing, you know? So anyway, I fell into that, did that. Then I ended up working and moving to New York and doing same thing, media publicity for the Today Show. And we were doing transitions of anchors and all that kind of stuff. I would say my first sort of, that was all the same, news and PR. And then my first maybe little jag, but it makes sense, is going over to corporate at NBC. And they were, you know, sort of early days of digital and interactive, and cable was obviously just kind of blossoming, so I did a bunch of that. And that was sort of my first taste of strategy. You know, it had been a lot of publicity, saying yes, saying no, managing stories, being in the newsroom, which I forever will love, which is why I think it's so much a part of me, and sort of ties to my childhood love of the news. Like, there's nothing more thrilling than being in a newsroom and listening to editorial meetings happen. And then the corporate side was really like, this is where the company is going. My first taste of like, what do we need to do to get there? And then what do we need to say to the world, sort of make it so and claim our spot.
So was it integrating the business side of the news?
Yes, that was my first taste of being with business executives. Working with on-air talent is fun and sexy and all those things. And I definitely worked with the executives on the news side, but really seeing sort of how my first taste of business strategy and how communications can have a seat at that table and what the role is, and then what happens if you don't, was incredibly important for my career. And then I got this opportunity to go work for GE, which owned NBC at the time. And so then moving up into corporate with a new CEO and a whole new strategy for the company, and a company that had been around forever, it was incredibly fascinating. And so that was another, but I can see where it looks linear, because my titles kept going that way. And I was, you know, still pretty young. And so it's that, what I tell people here is your 20s are sometimes you work hard, play hard, you're burning the candle at both ends. I mean, I have many stories of doing that, which are very like college. And then 30s, or my career was taking off and my family was growing at the same time, and it was pretty awesome and painful all at the same time. And then my 40s have been fantastic. So anyway, my jump, which is interesting, my sort of down the ladder, which I don't think could have happened without a move to the West Coast, because the East Coast mentality is very, you know, it is linear, and it is, you climb the ladder, and especially where I was in a big, you know, company, you kind of never did jobs that were lateral moves unless you were forced to. It's not looked upon in a good way like it is out here of like, yeah, I tried that, I failed that. You don't really hear that a lot there. It's all very much like, where did you go to school? What did you do? What's your job? Those are the first questions. And then we moved to, my husband got a job offer out here. And that is when I first took a job that I would say is back down the ladder. That was a job I had done probably 10 years prior in my career, but I was so burned out, and that's my sort of post rock bottom life. I tried not working for a while, and that sucked. I was terrible at it. I burned grilled cheeses. I didn't know what anyone's schedule was. I didn't like calling my husband in the middle of the day and being like, hey, I'm just hanging out doing some errands. And he'd be like, yeah, I am really busy in my meetings. And I would just slam the phone down and be like, "Urgh." So then I ended up taking a job at Condé Nast for Wired Magazine that's based out here. And so that was definitely a head scratcher for a lot of people, because it was hard for me, to be honest. You know, when I look back at making that decision, like, what will this mean? I knew the brand was incredibly strong. I had done work with Wired in my past life. I knew the editor-in-chief, the publisher. They're all amazing people. Condé Nast is a great company. So it wasn't that. It was more like, oh my gosh, I was up here, like, about to take a huge job in a company, right? That would have been my opportunity. And now I'm back sort of doing my Today Show almost, but for a magazine-type job. And it was hard I remember having to call my mom, and just being nervous, or even telling, you know, mentors or people I'd worked for, oh, this is what I'm doing, you know, and it turns out it was the best thing that I've done, for sure, because it sort of reconnected me to myself, to my family. I sort of relooked at my values, made sure I was living my life according to them, and that whatever next job I was going to have, to make sure that I wasn't giving up anything. And I think that's how I landed at Outkast. So it's definitely zigged and zagged.
Did you, in those, so it sounds like there were several pivotal moments in your career, one going from news being a publicist into corporate, and then from corporate at NBC and GE coming here, and then taking a job at Condé Nast. Were those like very conscious decision-making processes that you did, or was it something else?
Something else. I am not a 5-year planner. As much as I like to sort of know what's ahead, you know, and I'm definitely a scenario planner. If I do this, then this will happen. If I do, you know, so people who know me would probably laugh if they were listening to this right now. Like, I am the queen of mind effing things. So I'm not pretending that I'm like, yeah, whatever happens, and here I go. But my career is really, I've just sort of fell into things, and it's very much, obviously, I know that I worked really hard and I did a good job, but it's also people that I knew and opportunities that then I had because they knew me and knew what I could do. So it was kind of a combination is how I always looked at it, but I never said, I want that job. You know, when I went to GE, it was in communications first, but then I went over to the marketing side and I just didn't really think about it. I was kind of, you know, the opportunity seemed interested. They're definitely a kind of company that was always, once you mastered something, they would move you immediately. It's just how they roll. And so I think I just got used to that, you know? And so, I never, being bored, I don't even know what I would, if I say it would be terrible. But anyway, it's not my jam. So I think I just constantly was just looking for new opportunities. I took projects, but I never plotted out a career. I could never write a book. I'm like, here's how you do it, people, because it was never that way.
If you would have to formulate it in terms of a learning for you, and it's fair, it's what worked for you. But if somebody's listening to this and say, yeah, I identify with how Alex describes this, and I can see myself in it as well. What would you tell now in hindsight? What advice would you share with people who roll a little bit like you?
I think it's being incredibly self-aware and open. You know, it's sort of knowing, and I think that's the times that I've made, you know, not mistakes, but the times where I've gotten stuck or I felt really unhappy is because I was moving so fast that I never checked in with myself. And you were doing things for so many other people that you never were like, is this working for me? Is this, you know, what is this? And so to me, looking back, if I could have been And again, I have no regrets because here I am running a company. If I ever thought I'd be a CEO of a company, I mean, please, it was not on my list at all. But I think that notion of knowing if you're challenged or bored, knowing what you're capable of, even if you don't know what it looks like, but you know there's more there. And then I wish I had a better way of saying this. And open sounds just so bleh, right? But it is, in fact, I'm laughing at myself because now I'm remembering when I met with the founders of Outkast and they had reached out to me about not this exact job, but basically coming in to help them run the business. And I first was like, nope, thanks. No, couldn't possibly. I just had this third surprise baby. Like, I don't know what you're talking about, but no, love you guys so much. But I just, no. And I went home that night and I remember saying that to my husband. He was like, you're insane. Like, what are you talking about? Of course you could do this. You know, all of your GE training was, you basically got a mini MBA. You love leading people. Everything that they were talking about, you know, you could do. So I don't understand.
And what was it that was going on in your mind?
I was afraid that I would go back to giving up my life, you know, and that in my head, my only examples of CEOs and running companies, no matter, again, that this one's much smaller than a giant GE or an NBC or even Condé Nast, right? You know, they're just huge jobs and your life isn't your own. That is always my impression. And for a lot of those jobs, by the way, they are, right? You're just running a giant public company. Like, it's really hard. So I think I had those as my role models in my head and examples and watched those people up close and what their lives were like. I knew their schedules intimately. You're going, oh my, like, you don't even have time to go to the bathroom. Like, I don't even understand. So I think that was what I was mostly, was just the fear of getting sucked back in where you don't have control. And I think same thing with a client service business. I was worried that I'd always been the client and never, like, could I switch to be the side where I'm like, hey, love us, here's what I'm selling you. Like, it was a muscle I just didn't think I had.
Speaking of training the muscle, you said that two things to be, to have a good self-awareness and to be open. Is there a practice or an exercise or a framework, a mental model that you follow to develop the self-awareness?
So I think the people who know me and even from a long time would say I generally am a self-aware person. I'm pretty in touch with who, you know, with who I am. And I've gotten obviously lost along the way, not to major detriment, but just more, you know, cruising along. But I do think that when I turned 40 and I have this surprise for third kid. We love you, Theo, if you're listening later in life. You're the best. I did not go back after maternity leave. I did not go back to Condé Nast in my wire job, and I had time again to think. And I remember I went to the beach, which you can do here, which is awesome, which I love. It's one of my happy places, and answered some questions that I had gotten off the back of a book or something. And it was, you know, the two that I remember the most were, are you living your life according to your values? Are you creating an atmosphere of growth and development for yourself? And I think in answering those questions, that has stuck with me since that time of that I really at the end of the day wasn't doing those things. I would, you know, that I really should look for whatever I do next should really challenge and push me. Especially if you're going to work outside of the home and you have kids, you might, you know, you really need to, you know, being bored is sort of the most tragic in some ways. So that helped. And then when I got this Outkast job, I remember, I think one of the founders was already taking a chunk of time every summer, you know, three weeks or so. And I thought, God, if I could do that, if I could take that time to regroup, sort of back in touch with myself every year, you know, and go back east or whatever it was at that time. But if I could take that time and make that the time where I can check in with my kids, like, is this working for you? Check in with my husband. Like, are we good? You know, I know that sounds insane. Of course, you're trying to do date nights and whatever the hell, even though I'm terrible at that. But that would be my time every year that I would re-ask myself these questions. Like, is this job, am I still loving it? Or do they love me? Like, what else can I do? Or is everything cool? Awesome. Everything's cool. And I have done that every summer since, and it is fantastic. So it's just that time I carve where I, which will sound silly, but it's my, I basically am a stay-at-home mom for 3 weeks, which is a vacation for me. You know, I'm like throwing dishes. I'm yelling at them, like everything I don't get to do because I'm at the office every day, you know, and taking them to camps and cruising around. So it's not like we sit and stare and we're doing like crazy stuff. I'm living like a, you know, just a normal life, but it's my way of sort of getting back in touch. And then now that they're older too, we literally have that conversation. Like, is there anything else you need from me? Am I going to all your games that you want me to? And they've gotten so good at, especially obviously the older ones, like, you don't need to come to this instead. Or yeah, don't even worry about this, mom, I'm good. You know, and that really helps me. But that obviously takes a while to get there.
Do you remember what the title of this book was?
Yes. Okay. It's Gretchen Rubin. And I think it was The Happiness Project.
Yeah, great book.
Great book. And yeah. I had known her just super briefly. We were on a nonprofit board when I was in New York before I moved out here. And then I remember someone sent me her book when it came out. And I think I flew through, you know, self-help just in general is not a category that I necessarily have by my bed, but not that I'm above it. It's not my jam. But I remember going to this back and she had these questions. And I think I've sent them to literally 100 people since then, because it's just been so helpful for me. It was such a teeny exercise, and it's, you know, I realized I hate taking the garbage out. It also made you say like what things you do that frustrate you. And I was like, I don't like getting gas. So, you know, I run on empty. I literally drive the car on empty, and it drives my husband crazy. And I'm like, sorry, I just don't like it. So he usually fills up the car, and I don't like unloading the dishwasher. Like, and then what makes me happy, I remember because I just moved here, I was like, I love to recycle and compost, because back east, like, not very many places do it like they do here, where it's religion. And I was like, God, I feel like I'm doing something for the environment. This is amazing. I got my little compost holder, and it made me feel great. And I was like, great. And then reading, obviously, when going back to that, like, I had that as number one. So it was just this great little exercise. So definitely go and get The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin, just for the question.
Great tip. You mentioned earlier in our conversation that you, 7 years ago, did some exercises to learn about what makes you happy. Was that that book?
That was that. Okay. That was exactly that.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah, that was just sort of a quick check-in. And I've saved my notes. I mean, I laugh now when I do read that. Like, really? Compost makes me that happy? And now I'm like, I'm over compost.
Well, for me, it's I realize on my sabbatical that I love sparkling water above everything else.
Yeah, I can easily see it's a little. Well, that, I think that is the point. It was
it's the
little
thing about
things.
These consist like these little things that you can accumulate consistently over time, and they're small enough that they're achievable.
That's exactly
happiness, right?
That's exactly what that did for me.
It's not this one thing that happens once every 5 years.
No,
then, you know, the rest of the time you're unhappy.
And well, and even going to the grocery store, like not having anyone hanging on my. I don't like any. And that's another one I wrote down. I don't like, and I think it's more a metaphor for my life. I don't like anyone hanging on me. So like when kids are like pulling on my, you know, when they were little, like hanging on my legs or don't hang on me. And I think that is something I think I don't like getting, I get claustrophobic really quickly. I don't like anyone relying on me or needing me. So the happiest day in my life, does this make me sound like a terrible person? Is like when I don't need to do anything for a child. That sounds awful. But like, I could not wait to like chuck, I didn't like, when even my littlest one, like he just now can, this is going to sound so gross, you can edit this out, but like he just can go to the bathroom and he doesn't have to like call for me, where it's like, mom, you know, and I just, God, hearing that just would make my skin crawl. And so now I'm like, oh my God, amazing. Like that is done. Like we're done. Like everyone can take showers by themselves. They can get dressed by themselves. They can go to the bathroom by themselves. They can basically also feed themselves. And so I just feel like, my work here is done.
People. Sounds like a deep sense of independence there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want to go back and talk a little bit more about your transition into Outcast, because your first job here was as a chief operating officer,
yes.
Right? And then, so you took the job in 2010 and then a year later took the role of CEO. And I was curious, for people who are a little bit removed from this role of a chief operating officer and then also from a chief executive officer, what is the main difference in those two roles?
There's so many different kinds of COOs. And actually, I named a woman here, one of our partners, a COO last year. And we looked at a lot of these different models. The one I was hired to do was two founders who are two amazing women who are still clients of the agency and very wonderful and I'm in touch with all the time. they hired me basically, they had sold the company and were looking for someone to help them. They knew what they loved to do. They had done their list, right? We love client work. We love to be out there, but there's a bunch of stuff in running the day-to-day of the company that we are just kind of done. They each kind of, I think, have been 14 years for them. And so it was time. And so that was what I was hired to do. Actually, within 6 months, they both had moved on and to other jobs outside the company. And 6 months later, I was CEO. And so that transition was not as difficult as sort of, it just, you just sort of jumped in. So everything I was doing at that time, which was, you know, honestly, I just started. So it was getting my feet wet and how accounts were running. And is there anything else we could do to look at efficiencies there or, you know, client relations? I just started to sort of get my feet wet in that. Looking at our, you know, working with our HR team really closely, our finance team really closely, like those were the things that I had started to do. And so it was that plus then the big piece of this job, which is the client work. And that muscle, which I actually thought, because I had been in marketing for a while and had not been in touch with media in a long time in that same way, and just that, you know, it was like riding a bike again. And I didn't think I would love it as much as I did. And I missed it. And that part has been so much fun. So to me, that's a secret sauce of Outcast too, is that even running the company, I'm on at least a dozen teams here, working really closely with clients and CEOs and founders. And I absolutely love it.
Yeah, so that's a good point, because I was wondering about that. How much of your role as a CEO of an agency that does clients, so that offers client services, is spent with actually working with clients versus building the team and setting the vision and making sure things are in place to you know, drive
the
business?
I think we've spent a lot of time, again, with our 20th anniversary coming up right now, of like, what is our secret sauce and why has the company thrived for so long and grown? And there's so much of a foundation that Karen Maroney and Margaret Wenmachers, who founded the company, put in place that we've never touched, nor would we. And that was really it. It's a very hands-on, lots of senior people working with the clients. And I do think from my life of being a client, you know, for so long and having so many different, you know, agencies roll through with me, that is a huge differentiator, right? You usually got one or two people who might be good at strategy, but then there was a pretty junior team and they would sort of roll in and roll out, you know, pretty frequently. And it was, and honestly, I was probably a really crappy client because we were moving so fast inside that it was hard to sort of go, oh, yeah, we should tell our agency about that. Yeah, let's find out. We were just, it was more throwing stuff over the fence and being like, can you get this done for me? And that is exactly what Outcast is not. And I think that's what appealed to me to come here, is that I felt like that it was a different model. It was much more consultative, much more partnership. They absolutely get a lot of the execution, which is, I think, a really important thing that I love. I am definitely an eat in the weeds girl. But then my job is also to sell a vision to the employees, to our, you know, to our partners of what we do for companies and what we need to be as a company. But then, you know, I love me nothing more than alphabetizing name tags and making sure all that's right. You know, like it's all of it. so that is, I think, one of the things that's really special about Outcast, why I love it.
They say, like I've heard people say before, that the role of the CEO can be a very solitary thing. So I was curious, do you experience it that way as well? And if so, where do you go for advice?
I would say that was very much my experience in the very beginning, because I had many things that were, I would say, perceived knocks against me when I took this job. One, I'm not from here. You know, we have a large office in New York. We have an office in LA. We have people in Seattle and Philly and Boston and other places, but it definitely came from Silicon Valley and was very much of a tech communications agency is how it started. We're much broader now, but that was, and I came from GE, like basically is what they looked at on my resume and go, ugh, big company. You know, I was just a loser basically. and I just didn't know in my, you know, way around of Sand Hill Road. I didn't know the difference between a Series B and a seed round. I mean, I had so much to learn. So I had to sort of definitely overcome that. And when I wasn't an outcast, I had done a project. I had just been here 6 months, you know, so some of the company knew me, a lot of the company didn't. And certainly I definitely didn't know a lot of the clients. And so that caused me to retreat. I definitely felt very lonely for that first easy 6 months to a year. I felt that sort of proverbial prove yourself. And I think I tried a little too hard. When I look back, I probably over-rotated and I sort of pretended to be a CEO. And this, or at least from my examples I'd had in my career, I tried to do what other people did. And I had, to me, the pressure that was internal. No one was putting it on me, but of two founders who were incredibly well-known, well-beloved, incredibly successful. And this was not a turnaround. This was a don't F it up. and there's a different kind of pressure in that. And so what I ended up doing, I cried a ton. I gave off, I'm sure, horrible body language in meetings because I remember pulling up my legs and kind of hugging them. And I was a hot mess. So I ended up reaching out to an executive coach. I think I had lunch with somebody who said, you know what, you'd probably be really good to have an executive coach. And I hadn't had one in a long time. And so I was given the name of a couple people. I actually tried a few. One was almost like the Three Little Bears. I had one that was like yelling at me. He was a sales guy. And he'd come up through that and he'd literally sit across the table and yell at me. And I was like, this is not happening. And then I had one that I was on the phone. She was in Vancouver. Lovely, lovely woman. But was probably too soft with, you know, almost too soft. And then I found, one who was perfect for me for what I needed and worked enough with me also on the things that were kind of swirling in my head and got me, you know, to sort of put them out, whiteboard them, get clarity, but then also gave me really good practical advice, which is really also what you need and seek, because I really didn't want, you can't go out, you know, with your employees and let them see all of this. So at least I felt like that at the time. I think I'm much now more comfortable with myself as a leader. And I honestly think it was the age old, when did it turn for you, Alex, kind of thing, was when I just started being myself and realizing, like, what's the worst they can do? Fire me? Like, I'm going to suck. Like, okay, so I'll suck and they'll fire me. So I just started being me. And maybe you get a tiny taste of it in this, where, you know, in this podcast, but I, you know, I'm kind of out there and I share a lot. And I think I was being so restrained and like, this is me as CEO, that it took way too much energy and I wasn't doing the right things. And so I just freed myself up and then kind of went from there.
There's two things I would love to follow up. And you mentioned networking earlier in our conversation, and it also came up a little bit now when you described, when you first arrived here. What have you found to be very effective ways to network when you joined here? And then maybe we'll also talk a little bit about coaching and finding the right coach, the learning behind the experience of selecting a coach. Maybe start with networking.
Yeah. I am a natural connector. So I actually, networking is hard for me. I have one friend who laughs their ass off whenever I'm like, I'm a really bad networker. And then I'll be like, hey, Alex, how, you know, I'm Alex, you know, and I'm introduce myself within like 20 seconds of saying I'm a bad networker. It is not actually my comfortable place to network. I'm bad at events. I don't know anybody. I'm much happier by myself in a corner, weirdly, but for my job, I can't do that. Right. So I've had to learn ways to get around that, but I love connecting with people and I love people who connect me to other people. So I'm really good at one-on-one. Anyone who emails me is like, I would love, it drives my team crazy, but I'm like, yep, we'll meet. I love meeting new people. And I will never say no to a meeting. I just can't. It's like not in my body to do it. So that is something that I think I've always been. I love if I meet a, you know, best friend in, you know, high school, and then I, you know, meet someone I think that they should know, I love putting them together. And I've always been like that. So I think that's been very natural for me in this job. And I think this is what I try to tell people, and it's not like I want anyone here to leave, but I actually, my whole mosaic of my career and my life and living in different places, and it all comes together, you know? So I always try to show people who are just starting out, if, you know, you want good relationships wherever you go, because I can't even tell you what my LinkedIn explosion looks like of just people from all past lives. And at some point I just got one note from the guy who was like, oh my gosh, it says in my database, we talked in 2004 and I remember that. And here's what we talked about. And, you know, here's what I need today. And I was like, that's awesome. I love that. You know? And so to me, that is what this is all about. So I'm sort of glad that I left. I would hate to be in one company for my whole career. I don't think it serves anybody well.
Have you, what would be the top three tips for effective networking? Like, in terms of, you mentioned that you don't say no to a meeting. You love connecting with people. You love connecting other people with one another. How do you then balance this, the inbound requests with selecting where you want to spend your time, who you want to spend time with? Do you have a model around it, or is it, do you follow the flow?
No, much to the chagrin of, the people who work with me. What I have tried to do is look at my calendar in a more strategic way so that I leave myself time at the beginning of every day and the end of every day with nothing. And that's pretty sacred unless there's an emergency or someone who has to talk to me, and at least I know I have that time. So I usually try not to start anything before 9:30, even though I'm in at 8:30 so I can get work done. And then I try nothing after 4:30. And then I have my set meetings that I have every week, and then I am completely open. A new thing that I've started to do this year actually is leave 2 free open days per month. And that is very purposeful for outside meetings. And that could also include, time down. Our office is in the city, so I'll make a bunch of meetings down in the valley. And I'm also set another goal for myself of having 10 people that I don't know a quarter that I meet with. Because sometimes you can get in a rut where you're like seeing the same people over and over and over. And I want to make sure that I don't do that either. So I'm babbling because I'm not sure. Half of it is purposeful and the other half is opportunistic.
What have you found? I love this idea of meeting 10 new people per month. What have you found? What have you learned from that experience, from opening up your calendar for 10 people a month?
Well, I love the intake process of it. So I could sit here and, maybe it's my Larry King early days, but I could talk to people till they're blue in the face, and sort of and I end up asking, I think, personal questions too, that there aren't any off. I don't keep it stiff and like just professional. So you end up very quickly, and some are more successful than others, but making a connection over something with somebody. And I just love that. It just gives me energy, and I love learning new things. So I think to me it's inputs. We do the strength based leadership here, and so input's my number one after strategic, I think, and that it just is. It's what makes me roll. And so in searching and looking for those people, it's more, I have actually, we kind of go through, it's almost like a heat map of like, I'd like to get to know these people, who knows them, and then I kind of go after it. So it's less, I think what I would fear is that anyone would, and hopefully my personality someone would never say this, but the sort of very mechanical networking, I think I cringe at networking because to me it means very like, hi, I'm Bob, I'm looking for this, and here's what I want. And then it's like a transaction. And I don't, that's not what I'm talking about. It's just more like, yeah, I'll take that meeting. Or yeah, I'd love to go meet Sally. Do you know Sally? And then I go meet Sally and I'm like, oh, I did one yesterday actually. And we went on for like an extra half hour. We had such a great time. I had a couple action items, but they didn't feel like action items coming out of it. And she was going to do something too. And I was like, oh, this is, that made my day. So I'm looking for more of that.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like a transaction.
Yeah.
You talk about strength. I have strategic as well and input as well.
Funny. Yeah, oh, yeah.
So maybe for people listening to this, if you wonder what we're talking about, is this the Gallup Strength Finder?
The Strength Finder book. Yes,
yeah, Strength Finder book. So it's a great, great way for running some tests and then seeing, I think at the end of that test, there is an output of 5 strength.
That's right.
Which you can identify with or not. I think it worked well for me as a way to organize.
Yes, I'm so glad to hear
stuff.
That. Yeah. I forget how I was first introduced to the book, but we basically now as a new employee, so we did it all as a company 5 years ago maybe, and then everybody was very, put up their strengths. And so we actually use that also to staff teams, because everybody here is on at least 4 teams, some more depending on how senior you are. But generally speaking, most people are on 3 or 4 teams, which is actually not a lot for agencies. But we want to make sure those teams don't have, if you have all strategics and no execution, so how do we look at that and use that as a tool? And then now as an employee, you get that as your orientation and you just do your test, which is actually really fun. And then we share it with everybody.
Yeah, it's highly recommended. I'll put it in the show notes as well. It's
good.
$20 or something.
Yeah, exactly. And, super exactly. Cheap, it's awesome. And, it's super, and they have helpful. A second one out, but the first one has the test and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Alex, I want to talk a little bit about leadership. And you mentioned it already a bit in our conversation. How would leaders in your team describe you as a leader?
We just did 360s for our management team.
What's 360s?
A 360 review, performance review. And I hadn't had one in about 10 years, but I had saved it. So hilariously, many of the same things, I'm not proud of it, were still on there. But I think that they would say that I am extremely open, authentic. I push them, but I'm not, so I'm hard driving, but I have a soft, soft edges, if that makes any sense whatsoever, soft edges. But anyway, and I would say the things that still come up on the need to work on is that my, the very thing that I think that they will groove on, I'm a motivator. You know, I am, I hate saying like I'm inspiring and visionary because I just, I actually don't consider myself those things, but I do think I motivate people. I can get people going, but I have an intensity to it, and I, it can also suffocate people. So if they have an opinion, right, and or they have a, you know, a, what about this way or that way, or have you thought of or want to push back on me, that I give them almost no room to do it, because I'm like, I come off as so like passionate and that it just squeezes the air out of the room. So I'm trying very hard on that one, because I think that I've been the first place in my life or point in my career where I can really understand what that means, and slow down and try to give people room and breathe and not be all over everything all the time.
Have you found a way to practice that?
It's the self-awareness and the consciousness. Mm-hmm. So I'll be sitting in our management meetings and I'll be biting my lower lip really hard and be like, and basically literally saying to myself, don't step in this. And we actually, same thing, I brought in, we brought in a executive, outside executive coach, that the one I was working with, and did some really great teamwork. You know, and then we do sort of a diagnostic now on a yearly basis. Like, are we still good? Because I think we just, as any group of people do, we need to be real with each other and lay it all out there. And that's been really hard for me. I think there were many years in the beginning of this job as a CEO where I didn't want to know, and I didn't want to face into it. It was more like, this is how I am, and I'm not changing, kind of thing. And then I just, you know, you finally just get to that. Hopefully it was just confidence that sort of gave me like, all right, let's see what do I need to do? You know, that's better, and I'll do it.
What have you found to be one leadership skill that you would advise everyone to master?
Oh, that's so hard. Just one. I'm not great at this yet either. And if my husband's listening, he will also appreciate listening. You know, just really, really, am I an active listener? I always hear that phrase. I'm like, God, I would die to be an active listener. I need to still work on that. So I do think that helps, and I'm getting better for sure. But that just means I need to slow down. I need to have the conversation. I need to ask. I think that's been a tool that has been incredibly helpful. Like, who should I ask about this and get, you know, and have them weigh in? The job is actually not knowing everything. And I think I thought that was the job in the beginning, that I had to have the answer or else I'd be seen as weak. And that just isn't the case. So I think slowing down and asking.
Very counterintuitive thing about leadership is you think you need to have all the answers because you're at the top or whatever, wherever a leader is positioned in the organization, but it's actually not knowing everything. It's about assembling a team that knows everything.
Exactly. And being okay, not like there's so much busy work that you could be doing in this job. And then how do you free yourself up? Which is how I think I got to the, like, can I carve out time for my head just to be free? And that feels weird too. You know, it's sort of the hangover of many years of starting out in old school corporate America, where like if you read a magazine or took a break, you were lazy, or you might be perceived as lazy. So you never did it. You just kept going. And I think I still have that, like, oh gosh, what if they see me and I'm not busy? and I've had to get over that too. You know, that some of my job is to just think and to go off and do other kinds of activities. And that's something I've had to come into.
Yeah. And I think that applies for every job. It's like, you need to have some time to think and not be busy all the time.
That's right. And we have that in spades here and for what we do on client service. Cause also sometimes your calendar isn't your own. So we've been really trying to coach and give people some trainings on how to do that, because their job is to give strategic advice to the client. But if you have no time to do that, then we're cutting off our nose to spite our face. So
back to coaching, is there one thing somebody can do who can't find a coach or can't afford a coach? Is there something you would advise them to do?
Well, yeah. And I want to, this is such a great question, because I want to be really clear that that is if your company doesn't do that for you, which a lot of companies do, and if they aren't able to, and then you're something that you can't afford on your own, to me, what it's really great, and some I sort of coach and mentor to me hand in hand. I have so many different mentors and coaches in my life, and many of them are, most of them, except for the one, are unpaid and are just come from all kinds of walks of life. And it sort of depends on what you need at that time. But I think it is the same kind of tenets of like, are you, what is the question? What are you trying to solve? And then who is the best person that can help you with that? Because I have some coaches that are great for me on like, how do I juggle my whole life with this job? It's really hard. I have a dual career, you know, a husband who works really hard and travels, the kids, all that stuff. So there are some people who are in that space for me that I can call up at any time and say, oh my gosh, you know, how are you dealing with this? And then I have more of the CEO of the agency life ones. And then I have, you know, working women ones. I mean, there's just so many different facets that you probably have them. Think about the people, think of the issues you're having and then who in your life. And oftentimes I'm super old school and I kill trees, so just don't kill me. I print out my contact list, which is huge over all these years. And I really hate deleting people because you're just in that, like, you never know when I might need to connect someone to connect someone. So I end up going through it and then I'll either reach out or, you know, if I needed to or whatever. So I keep everyone's contact info. And I've reached out over the years to lots of different people in my past life, as well as just new people I've met and have those kinds of conversations. And people are always willing to do it. I know people, you know, anyone who says no, I just don't get. But anyway, I'm sure that will happen. So
yeah, I think it's such a great piece of advice to think about the issue that you're trying to solve and then find a person around it versus the other way around, which I hear often is, oh, I'm looking for a mentor.
I hate forced mentorship. And then, it's a passion of mine. You know, I can't stand it. I don't think you can do it. We try to do that here. And I was like, ew, I don't. It's so much of it is chemistry and where you are. Sorry to interrupt. That was my New Year's resolution.
No,
every
good.
Year is not to interrupt people. And then every year by January 10th, it's done. So anyway, I apologize for interrupting you. But I really believe that's such a thing of mine. I can't stand mentor programs like that. I mean, there's a really wonderful place for them in the nonprofit world and Best Buddies and all of that. And I just mean like corporate ones. It's really hard.
How can then somebody who hears this and say, okay, I get this. It's about defining the issue I'm facing. And so let's say somebody has defined that issue or defined the questions. What is the next step? What would you advise them to do? Go on LinkedIn or like what is something that they can do?
LinkedIn is hard. I think it's hopefully unless you really work at home by yourself and don't have that network. I always start with who's sitting around, you know, who's kind of closest to me, literally and figuratively. And then I go from there. Like, here's a problem. And this may be me. So I'm going to be hard with advice for people who aren't comfortable talking about their problem or their issue. Because I'm such an open person, I have, you know, now gotten really used to being like, I'm having a hard time with this. Is there anyone you know that I could talk to about it? So I think the first challenge is just making sure you're comfortable explaining what the issue is, because no one's going to get inside your head. You have to be able to be clear with people. And I say that even for job stuff, when people come to me for advice or want to meet about that, and you sort of ask what do you want to do? You know, and everyone, I don't know. And I'm like, okay, that's your first thing. Don't go meet with people. You can with me, but like, don't go meeting with people when you don't have a clear sense. So I think it's being really clear about what your thing is. And then just letting, the more people you let know, the more your chances are you're going to get connected to someone who can help you. And that's really what's happened to me. Even if the person I'm talking to can't be like, oh, I don't know, but you know what, let me ask, you know, Bob. And then somehow it comes back to you. I just, you know, so that's my best advice. It's probably not super clear, but.
So people who aspire to reach a C-level executive position role, like you had in as a CEO and a CEO, what piece of advice do you give them onto that journey if they're earlier in a career?
I have two things that I'm incredibly grateful for that I think set me up to do this because I don't have an MBA. But I worked in companies that did a lot of training and development for their employees. And I'm incredibly grateful. My husband, we both met at NBC and we had the same sort of GE. I think they spend like $1 billion a year in training their employees. So we got a lot of management training. We do that a lot here. It's something I brought to the company that I just believe so strongly. I want everyone here to be good business and good people managers. So understanding business and getting the fastest look you can from inside a company's point of view, and by the way, researching outside. So if, even if an MBA or any, you know, I actually thought about doing that, or an executive one. And at the end of the day, I thought, you know what, I'm getting one by just doing the job the way I need to. And I had small kids and it just wasn't on the table for me. But I do think making sure you're incredibly savvy and educated, and at least understand what business strategy, business goals of your company, going to every, you know, town meeting you can with your CEOs, getting to know your executives. You know, it's the same thing I'm telling my kids now with their teachers, like, don't just sit there, like, go, you know, go meet as many people as you can and get tied in there. And so I think the business strategy for sure. And then a huge part of this that I love is the people management part. So getting that down and making sure that that's part of your repertoire or toolkit or strength of yours, I think is, you know, you may not want to be an HR person. I understand that. But honestly, being at a company where your HR person and your CFO are sort of right there with you running a company, and that was sort of the GE model, I completely see how that is now. And so to me, it's the same. Even I use my NBC experience, right? It's not Katie Couric or Tom Brokaw. I'm dating myself. But it is, the lighting guy was as important, the prop guy, the script writer, you know, the journalist, the investigative journalist, you know, and the executive. Nothing can happen without a team of people. And what is the best way to get that team to do what you need them to do at an excellent high bar every day? That is a skill that I think, you know, I was trained to do, and I love that part of it. I love it. And so if you don't, it's really hard to run a company, because we see that a lot here, right? With culture is such an important thing now with companies, and you see what happens to companies when they don't treat culture and their employees, you know, with the importance that it should. And it can mean a real failure and a business risk. So that's something I'm incredibly grateful. And I would say to anybody starting out that those are two muscles you need to build.
Yeah, it's great advice. Combining the business acumen with the people manager skills, and then taking the HR as a partner, taking the HR department as a partner,
corner. That's right. Culture is not an afterthought. Yeah. You know, and learning to run something efficiently. I mean, that is at the end of the job, at the end of the day. This isn't a public company, but we're a part of a public company. And so running the business in an efficient manner, when I look back at it, I'm like, God, I got so much out of all of my experiences, but through osmosis as much as me actively seeking it out. And actually, one of the best things I ever did was take annual reports and, you know, sit down, ask the IR person if, you know, that part of the business is I'm terrible at. I mean, just, and also owning that, like, I run a business, but the CFO, like, I'm a terrible numbers person, but I need enough to understand what's going on. And so making sure that I sort of went and said, would you mind spending a couple lunches with me? And that's what we did. And he went through line by line with me, and that was super helpful.
Yeah, there's a good nugget of advice there as well. So doesn't mean like developing that skill doesn't mean you have to go and learn a big program and finance and business and all of that. Can be with a series of lunches with the subject matter expert and say, hey, it's just, we both need to eat. Let's just go and tell me everything you know about your world.
Yes.
That's a great.
And
great
how, yeah. And how to even read the back of the book of an annual report. I was, you know, for what we do, the storytelling at the front is usually what we were responsible for with the executive team, but the back was just this blinding, you know, group of numbers. But to really understand that, and then again, just sitting in meetings, having that seat at the table and being able to just hear the arguments and the discussions, you just get a ton out of it.
Alex, we're running out of time. Oh, I want to make sure we cover our classic questions.
Oh, okay,
that we have on a podcast. This is the Role Models podcast. Do you have a role model yourself?
I have many, probably, that you would pick up on through there. But, you know, I have one teacher in high school that really just was my first one that really inspired me, and then really my family. So I can't say just one, and no one famous, really just regular people in my life.
What piece of advice would you give your 14-year-old self?
I think if I could, I have two. One is apply myself. I think when I look back, I just was doing this. My parents I still live in the childhood home that I grew up in, but they're definitely clearly weeding stuff out. So they're like, here is a bunch of your crap. So I was showing my oldest son my report cards, the old school handwritten ones. And most of the ones I had good grades, not straight A's, but gosh, imagine what, you know, Alex could do if she really applied herself, was a common theme. And it kind of was startling to me. I just was reading this the last couple of months. And so if I look back at 14, I think I was, you know, as usual, and I was a girl, I was maybe a freshman in middle school, eighth grade. And you're just, I know I can go back so quickly that I wasn't as focused as I could be. And I don't think I've turned out any worse for the wear, but I feel like just from the old, you know, gosh, I wish I could go back to college and imagine what I would learn in those classes instead of being hungover or whatever. I feel like that a little bit. I wish I had put more intent and focus at that time.
When will you know that you've been successful?
I change up my definition of success all the time. So I don't, in the same vein as I don't have a plan where I'll be able to check a box. I think I have a lot of the work as hard as you can for as long as you can in me. And so to me, it's about evolution. And so success will be that I am just constantly pushing myself to try something new, to learn something new, to not, you know, I hope that frankly, I'm not here right forever. No one wants me here forever. I don't want to be here forever. So it's sort of, you know, that there is a bar that I am constantly just trying to jump over, and be a little bit better than I was before, you know, and better to me isn't performing better. It's just stimulated and challenged intellectually, and that I feel super connected to my family.
Alex, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I wish you an excellent break.
Thank you so much.
History tour along the East Coast.
Thank you. I hope it is. I don't come back. Sort of, if someone said to me, "Oh gosh, I wish you were in, you know, doing something for yourself for all that time," and I'm like, "Actually, this is." So I hope I'm not as frazzled as I go, because it sounds like a lot of movement now that I'm thinking about it. But I think it'll be fantastic. So thank you.
I'm sure you'll have a great time. Yes. Thanks for coming on the podcast. You've been very generous.
Thank you
with
for
your
having
time.
Me. I'm very thank honored. You.
Thanks to Alex for sharing her story, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you're wondering about how you can help this podcast, then the best way to do that is to go to iTunes, click subscribe, post a short review. This will help us rise through the ranks of the wide iTunes charts, and this is the best way to help us reach more people like yourself. If you would like to share feedback, you can reach us on Twitter at Role Models or at David, or just send us an email, hi@rolemodels.co.